From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. North Korea said Tuesday's missile launch was a new Hwasong-15 ballistic missile that can reach all of the U.S. mainland. The missile is said to have reached an altitude of some 4,000 kilometers and flew nearly 1,000 kilometers before crashing within Japan's exclusive economic zone. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis said the North continues to test missiles that threaten the world.
In response, the South Koreans have fired some pinpoint missiles out into the water to make certain North Korea understands that they could be taken under fire by our ally. But the bottom line is it's a continued effort to build a threat, sir, a ballistic missile threat that endangers world peace, regional peace, and certainly the United States.
Analysts said on a normal trajectory, the missile could reach most of the U.S. Former Army Lieutenant Colonel Danny Davis, now with the DefensePriorities.org, said he believes the North is not intent on attacking the U.S.
I don't think that the intent is to antagonize anything. I think they have an absolute terror of a U.S. attack. And so I think that they feel like they have to accelerate their testing as fast as possible so that they have a weapon system that they feel will deter us.
The U.N. Security Council is set to meet on the matter later Wednesday. France has called on the U.N. Security Council to consider imposing targeted sanctions on human traffickers operating in Libya following release of a video appearing to show African migrants being sold into slavery. Carl Skau is the deputy Swedish ambassador.
Like others, we have been horrified and outraged by the video footage released last week of human beings reportedly being bought and sold as slaves in so-called slave markets in Libya.
The UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, said many of the migrants are subjected to torture, rape, sexual exploitation, slavery, and other forced labor. This is VOA News. A Syrian government delegation is expected to arrive Wednesday in Geneva to take part in a UN-backed round of peace talks trying to end the Syrian conflict. UN Special Envoy Stefan de Mistura said he hopes to be able to encourage direct dialogue between the government and opposition.
The opposition has indicated in Riyadh they want to have now, and they are ready, and they are unified, a direct discussion with the government. I will ask tomorrow the government whether they are ready to do the same. If by any chance this is complicated and difficult, and mediator is supposed to be very creative.
Seven rounds of Geneva talks have so far failed to reach a breakthrough to end the nearly seven-year conflict. The government delayed its arrival over the opposition's insistence that President Bashar al-Assad not be part of any post-conflict political transition. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence Tuesday said President Donald Trump is actively considering ways to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. He was speaking in New York at an event marking the 70th anniversary of the U.N. vote leading to the creation of the Jewish state.
And while for the past 20 years, Congress and successive administrations have expressed a willingness to move our embassy, as we speak, President Donald Trump is actively considering when and how to move the American embassy in Israel from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
U.S. Congress passed a law in 1995 making it U.S. policy to move the embassy, but concerns over its impact on the Israel-Palestinian peace process allows the president to renew a six-month waiver. Mr. Trump campaigned on a pledge to move the embassy to Jerusalem. Pence will address the Israeli Knesset or parliament during a visit to Israel next month. British newspapers are reporting Britain and the European Union have reached agreement on a divorce measure expected to involve a payment by London to Brussels of some 50 billion euros. Neither side is commenting on the reports. The British government said intensive talks on so-called Brexit continue, but acknowledges recent momentum to strike a deal. The next phase would then be a post-Brexit trade relationship. Britain is expected to complete the divorce or Brexit by March 2019. French President Emmanuel Macron announced a billion-euro fund for small and medium-sized African businesses, part of a bid to bolster French influence during a three-nation trip through West Africa. Mr. Macron addressed youth leaders in Burkina Faso Tuesday, saying he belongs to a new generation of European leaders who wish to build partnerships, not tell Africa what to do. The result from the Honduran presidential election remains uncertain, with TV game show host Salvador Nasralla's lead against incumbent center-right President Juan Orlando Hernandez dwindling. Final results may not be known until Thursday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, November 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. France calls for sanctions and prosecution of human traffickers in Libya.
These abject practices are not merely intolerable from the moral standpoint. They also constitute crimes against humanity. They cannot be left unpunished.
That's Francois Delatte, the French ambassador to the United Nations, speaking Tuesday through an interpreter. French President Emmanuel Macron continues his visit to West Africa today with a stop in Ivory Coast. A former Sierra Leone vice president urges his country to obey the judgment of the ECOWAS court. And Zimbabwe struggles to face Mugabe-era crimes as a former finance minister is on trial for corruption.
I think that they're just using him to try and portray an image of dealing with, you know, corruption and so on. But the cases that my client is facing, these are very old cases. It's just to harass him and then to try and create the impression that we are dealing with corruption.
Lovemore Maduku is the lawyer for Mugabe-era former finance minister Ignacio Chombo. The wife of former South Sudan first vice president Riek Machar says she's concerned about the safety of her husband. And we'll tell you about the inspiration behind Nigerian hip-hop music. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The plight of migrants in Libya was the focal point of a UN Security Council meeting yesterday, Tuesday, after the U.S. television network CNN aired shocking footage of African migrants apparently being sold as slaves in the country. As VOA's Margaret Bashir reports from the United Nations, envoys called for the prosecution and the possible imposition of sanctions on human traffickers and their networks.
The footage that aired last week sparked international outrage, including protests in Europe and Africa. Young men from Niger and other sub-Saharan countries were shown being auctioned off as farm workers for about $400. Libya's UN envoy El Mahdi El Majerbi said the government is investigating the CNN video, but he questioned its authenticity and said his country is the victim of a large-scale false media campaign of defamation trying to portray Libya as a racist country. French ambassador to the United Nations, Francois Delatte, whose government called for the council meeting, said victims are subjected to horrific human rights violations, including rape, torture, and arbitrary detention. He's heard here through an interpreter.
These abject practices are not merely intolerable from the moral standpoint. They also constitute crimes against humanity, and they mustn't, they cannot be left unpunished.
The UN envoy recommended the council impose targeted sanctions against individuals implicated in human trafficking and suggested that perpetrators could be referred to the International Criminal Court for prosecution. Several council members also urged measures to address the root causes of forced migration, especially poverty, and they called for opening new legal pathways for migrants. UN High Commissioner for Refugees Filippo Grandi said some 17,000 migrants are in detention in Libya, and many more are being held by smugglers and traffickers who are protected by militia groups. He said the United Nations has secured the release of about 1,000 asylum seekers and refugees this year. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
French President Emmanuel Macron continues his three-day visit to West Africa today with a stop in Ivory Coast. Yesterday, Tuesday, Mr. Macron met with university students in Burkina Faso. Brian Postomus reports for VOA from Ouagadougou.
He's the first French president in 3 decades to visit Burkina Faso. President Emmanuel Macron spent 3 hours on Tuesday at the University of Ouagadougou discussing migration, climate change and terrorism with a room full of students. In his remarks, the French president said he would pursue equal partnership with African nations, breaking with the more paternalistic relationship of old, a relationship between France and its former colonies known as the France-Afrique. Many in Ouagadougou welcomed the change.
Le message que j'ai à son égard est de revoir vraiment la France-Afrique.
Batigadou Ndekabore, a government worker enjoying his lunch in a canteen near Ouagadougou City Hall, says times have changed. He says he would like to tell Macron that the generation you are dealing with today is different from the ones that went before. Security was a key concern during Macron's visit. Police and army patrolled around all the main arteries, including the Kwame Nkrumah Avenue, scene of two major terrorist attacks in the past. In his university address, President Macron was full of praise for the regional French anti-terrorist force Barkhane. The force has been criticized by Burkinabe civil society groups, who call it an example of neo-colonialism. Burkina Faso government spokesman Rémi Fulgano Dangenou.
Je pense que la bonne politique c'est que les pays s'occupent eux-mêmes de leurs problèmes.
The best policy is of course when a country runs its own security, he says. But the fact remains that the problems that are happening in the Sahel region concern not only the countries in that region. This means that not only the Sahel countries but also France, the EU, the United Nations play their part. France has been busy drumming up international support for the newly created G5 force, which it hopes can take over the war on terror in the Sahel. The G5 is comprised of troops from five African nations, including Burkina Faso. Back at the university, Macron engaged in a lively debate with students following his speech.
C'est un peu la gouvernance en dessous des tables, comme vous l'avez dit, vous êtes contre fortement la corruption, les pratiques malsaines de notre administration.
The students inevitably brought up names from the past. Thomas Sankara, the slain revolutionary leader and the national hero. And Norbert Zongo, the journalist allegedly killed on the orders of François Compaoré, the younger brother of ex-president Blaise. Macron will head to Ivory Coast on Wednesday for a European Union-African Union summit expected to address migration. The French president will then wrap up his trip to the region Thursday in Ghana. Bram Posthumus for VOA News, Ouagadougou.
Former Sierra Leone Vice President Sam Soumana says he would advise the Sierra Leone government to obey the judgment of the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, Court of Justice. The court ruled this week that President Ernest Bai Koroma acted illegally when he sacked Sam Soumana as his vice president in 2015. The court ordered the Sierra Leone government to pay the former vice president his full salary, along with other allowances lost since his dismissal. The government has said the ECOWAS court has no competence and jurisdiction over Mr. Soumana's sacking, and as such, it refused to participate in the court proceedings. Mr. Soumana joins us now from Abuja, Nigeria. Good morning to you, Mr. Vice President, and welcome to Daybreak Africa.
Thank you very much. This is a victory not only for Sam Soumana, the elected vice president of Sierra Leone, but a victory for the people of Sierra Leone, West Africa and Africa as a whole, because it's a restoration of democracy and the rule of law back into the books of the Constitution of Sierra Leone.
So, sir, I know you had asked for damages of, I think, about $250 million. Do you still want that money, and what are you going to do with it?
The fiscal aspect is not what I'm looking at. My concern is the restoration of the rule of law into Sierra Leone. With the president of Sierra Leone, Ernest Koroma, acting contrary to the Constitution, this should be the primary issue that we should be discussing here. And that is what the court has already done.
I did speak with presidential spokesman Abdoulaye Birite, and the Sierra Leone government also put out a statement saying that they do not recognize the competence and the jurisdiction of the ECOWAS court. As a result, they did not send representation. What's your comment to that?
That is ridiculous, because Sierra Leone is a signatory, a very pronounced signatory to the ECOWAS Treaty. And we have benefited from the ECOWAS community in the past when we had a civil strife in our country. Very recently, I would say within the tenure of office of Ernest Koroma as president, the government of Sierra Leone, under his leadership, paid damages to Mohamed Wanza of $25 million on an economic crime issue. There was also an issue of abuse of human rights to a police officer who was also awarded damage of $250,000. On both cases, the government of Sierra Leone did not make an appearance, just like they did not make an appearance this time. But in a way, why would they also send a letter to the court if they don't have so that they don't have a jurisdiction? So it doesn't, whoever might have said that, I think he needs to go and check up properly and know that Sierra Leone is not an exemption to the ECOWAS Treaty.
Sierra Leone is preparing for elections, presidential elections in 2018. A few weeks ago, I spoke with you here on Daybreak Africa. You indicated your interest running for president. Are you still interested in running for president? And do you think this victory you've won will have any impact on your decision to run?
Yes, I am going to run for the presidency of Sierra Leone come March 7 elections. And to the second part of your question, What I had promised the people of Sierra Leone was to go out and fight for the redemption of the people of Sierra Leone at any level in order to restore the dignity of the Constitution of Sierra Leone. And that I have done at the ECOWAS Court.
You have been quoted as saying that you would advise the government of Sierra Leone to obey the judgment of the ECOWAS Court. How do you want the government to obey? To give you back your position as vice president?
The court has made a ruling, and I want the government of Sierra Leone to obey the rulings of that court. And I think that's the mature thing to do.
Does that mean you want the money? Because the court said that you should be paid your salary arrears. Do you want that?
This annulment is my right, what I have presented to the court as breach of my human rights. And whatever the court gives out as my emolument or whatever the court ascribes, I am going to go by that. And I have news for the people of Sierra Leone at the end of the day.
Former Vice President Sam Sumana, thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Elected Vice President, please. Thank you so much.
Samia Sam Sumana is the former sacked Vice President of Sierra Leone. He was speaking with me from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Today is Wednesday, November 29th, and you are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Zimbabwe's incoming president has acknowledged that the country has a troubled past, rife with human rights abuses at the hands of the ZANU-PF party that ruled Zimbabwe for nearly four decades under Robert Mugabe. However, Emmerson Mnangagwa's inauguration last week has been followed by several high-profile corruption cases against his political enemies, which critics say are just show trials to avoid addressing more serious crimes. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Harare.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa sees only one way forward for his wounded nation, battered by human rights abuses and endemic corruption: forgiveness.
I just have an appeal to all of us that we make right
But just a day later, the state jailed former Mugabe-era minister Ignatius Chombo on massive corruption charges.
I think that they're just using him to try and portray an image of dealing with, you know, corruption and so forth. But the cases that my client is facing, these are very old cases. I think the most recent is 2005, which shows that there's nothing really serious for on his part. It's just to harass him and then to try and create the impression that we are dealing with corruption.
Human rights lawyers say there are worse crimes and more serious culprits who are being protected.
If there are crimes that have been committed, everybody should, in fact, be put on trial. It shouldn't be selective at all. It shouldn't depend on which faction you belong to. Are you on our side or the other side? If the law is being used to right wrongs of the past, this should be done with everybody.
Many Zimbabweans do not want former leaders to rest in glory. Patson Zamara's older brother, Itai, was abducted in 2015 for opposing Mugabe. He is still missing.
The current president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, played a very major role. And so he's complicit. He's a part of, or he was a part of that arrangement and government. And for us to sweep that under the carpet and say that was that and life just has to go on as though nothing happened, I don't think it's proper.
Churches, which occupy a powerful role in Zimbabwe, are also struggling with the notion of letting bygones be. Pastor Chris Oporocha says he looks to other African nations for guidance.
In Zambia, we saw when President Levi Mwanawasa came into office, Chiluba, who was the outgoing president, was not given any immunity. He had to pay for the crimes that he did. He might not be sentenced to prison, but whatever evil has been done should be brought to light so that those people are dealt with.
Zimbabwe, its people agree, has to move forward, but no one thinks it will be easy. Anita Powell, VOA News, Harare.
Father Fidelis Mukonuri, a Catholic priest who mediated talks between Zimbabwe's former president Robert Mugabe and the military generals who toppled him, says Army General Constantino Chiwenga confronted former First Lady Grace Mugabe over allegations she had wanted the general eliminated. In this exclusive interview with VOA's Zimbabwe service, Father Mukonori, for the first time, revealed that Mrs. Mugabe did attend some of the meetings between Mr. Mugabe and the generals. Father Mukonori spoke with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA's Zimbabwe service on the last hours leading to President Mugabe's resignation.
He came to this decision because he was thinking. We were discussing. It was not like as if he just woke up suddenly and just said, this is what I'm going to do. So the last couple of days, I could read that the man was thinking various options. I mean, he's an intelligent man. At 93, I mean, he would see that 60,000 people had marched. There is a demonstration to say they're not happy. That he could see. And that it had never happened for our armed forces to leave the barracks with their trucks going into the street. That's not a simple issue to take place. So he read all that. He could see that. We were not playing games. Eh? We were talking as men. We were discussing as mature people. It was not a game.
And there are these reports that when he eventually agreed to step down, he did shed some tears. Is that true?
Yes. There are people who think they can talk as if they were present. I was the mediator. In fact, when he read the last letter and he took his pen and signed, his face just glowed as a sign of relief and of saying, you know, finito, it's done.
Did the former First Lady feature in any of these discussions?
She came in when she had to. But she was not the major focus. We were zeroing in on the commander-in-chief of the defense forces and the head of state and the government and the secretary of ZANU-PF, which was President Robert Mugabe. We didn't want to lose focus. The First Lady was the secretary for women affairs, and therefore that, in my view, it was part and parcel of the responsibility of the president. So we didn't have to take that as a major issue. She was part of the issue, yes, within the confines of the cases as they were coming all over the place. But that was not the center focus as far as I was concerned.
But then there were also reports that there were allegations that people wanted to arrest or eliminate General Chiwenga. Did that come up for discussion?
It did. But it was denied. I brought up the issue personally during the discussion period with the commanders.
But were they speaking with one voice? We saw a lot of, you know, senior officials in the security sector. Were they all agreed? Is that the sense that you're getting?
My brother, these are highly intelligent people and well-educated people. They had a long haul of reflection. Their discussions were just second to none. The singleness of purpose was clear.
Father Fidelis Mukonori helped mediate the talks that led to President Robert Mugabe's resignation. You're speaking from Harare with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe service. The family of former South Sudan first vice president and leader of the rebel SPLM-IO, Riek Machar, says they are concerned about Machar's safety in South Africa. Angelina Ten, who is a senior member of the SPLM-IO and wife of Machar, says she has credible information about a plan by the South Sudan government to assassinate her husband, who is under house arrest in South Africa.
I'm more than worried because there's this information that from very credible sources that I cannot just ignore, saying that there is a plan to murder my husband, Dr. Riek Machar, who is in confinement in South Africa. And the story goes like this. A minister, South African minister, has actually visited Juba, had a close meeting with Thabane Ndlovu and Ezekiel Lol. On his way back to South Africa, he was followed by two security operatives from South Sudan. And those two security operatives from South Sudan are back in South Sudan, and they have actually given a report saying that the plan is only a matter of time, that they have everything is put in place with regards to how and when to murder Dr. Machar in South Africa. And I don't take this lightly because this information comes direct from the office of Taban himself, people who know what is happening.
Taban Ndlovu, from my understanding, is your cousin. Why would he do something like that to your husband?
You don't choose your relatives. You may choose your friends. You happen to be born in the same family I'm born in. It doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, we think the same and we do the same. But you have seen what Taban would do for power, the crisis of 2016. Basically, Taban was totally behind it because Taban was eager to actually take the position of the first vice president. Well, I have no problem with him being first vice president of that regime in Juba. And actually, he made a statement in our meeting in Pagag when he came back for briefing us from the advance team. And he made a statement and he said he was told by President Salva that you keep following Riek Machar. If you were not following Riek Machar now, you would be vice president. He said this in a meeting, in an IO meeting where we had over 100 people. So he does this for power, and for whatever reason, he thinks so family means nothing to him. So I don't want to go into that. I'm talking about my husband now. I'm talking about his life. And there are many people who were involved in keeping him in South Africa. So I'm talking to those people now.
What are the people who are involved in keeping him in South Africa telling you right now? Because I know that you must be having friends in South Africa. What are they telling you?
I'm being told that, yes, the two operatives of security have come to South Africa. What they came for is what they cannot tell me because they don't know why they came. They are also concerned. But I'm saying this to the chairman of IGAD, Prime Minister Desalegn, who is actually leading this peace process in South Sudan, that he has a responsibility to ensure the safety and the life of Dr. Machar, because we are told IGAD was saying that, and IGAD has said this so many times, that he was detained in South Africa in the interest of peace. So that's one. I'm also now appealing to the president of South Africa that Dr. Machar is a husband, is a father. He may be a politician in South Sudan. He may be a leader in South Sudan, all of that, and so on. And if he has anything that he has to answer to in courts of law, he is also a citizen that is supposed to abide by law like any other citizen. Nobody should be allowed to be treated in that way. Nobody should be accomplice to this murder. So I think President Zuma has the power to ensure the safety and the life of my husband.
That's Angelina Tain, a senior member of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition and the wife of rebel leader Riek Machar. When contacted for comment, the executive director in the office of South Sudan First Vice President declined to comment, saying only that VOA should contact the government spokesman instead. As linguist studying the use of vernacular in hip-hop music in Nigeria, Alexandra Isemaji looks at ways that lyrics help communicate ideologies. As a speaker at the 12th International Language and Development Conference taking place in Dakar this week, Isemaji spoke to Ricky Stryak about what makes Nigerian hip-hop unique and an expression of political will for the youth.
I see the uniqueness, especially in the fact the cultural implications of words, cultural meaning of words, and the fact that the society is unique in various ways, and there are certain things, the things that are taboo in Nigeria, not necessarily taboo in other parts of Africa. And so hip-hop uses a lot of indirectness to speak to people of that in-group, and so they use words to conceal meanings that will be obvious to the adult population. Meanwhile, they're communicating amongst themselves, and that is unique.
Are there any specific local languages that you specialize in when you're looking at hip-hop, or is it English?
English is used by hip-hop artists, because it's an official language. We look at what hip-hop artists do with the English language, how they use it in pidgin, how they pidginize it, and then how there is code switching, they move from pidgin to local languages. So every hip-hop artist wants to bring to the fore his own local language, and also to, in order to draw in people from other local languages, they throw in certain words from these other languages so as to include them in the music.
That was Alexandra Isemaji, a linguist at the University of Benson in Idaho. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Dakar. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clouty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good Wednesday.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
VOA News is always at the tip of your finger.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.